too. Maybe the dead professor's two assistants to boot. Butters, we have to get you behind my wards again. He blinked at me.
But why? I mean, they wanted me so that they could get to the information. I'm useless to them now.
You and I know that. They don't.
Oh.
Billy, I said, could you please take Butters over to my place? No problem, he said. What about you? Won't you need wheels? The Beetle is ready. I'll take a cab. I can drop you off, Billy offered. No, it's the opposite way from my apartment, and Butters needs to get there yesterday. Go around the block once or twice before you pull in. Make sure no one is watching the door. Billy smiled. I know the drill. Don't try to open the door yourself, Butters. Knock and wait for Thomas to do it.
Right.
Butters fretted at his lip a little.
What are you going to be doing?
Detective stuff. I have places to go and people to see. And with a little luck, none of them would kill me. Chapter 16. Billy's apartment was only a couple of blocks from Bach-ordered books, and while I could have taken a couple of alleys to make the trip even shorter, I kept on the open streets where there were plenty of people. I didn't see anyone following me, but if there was a good enough team on me, or if they were using veils to hide their presence, of course, I might miss them. I kept my staff in my right hand and made sure my shield bracelet was ready in case anyone tried some kind of variant on the old drive-up assassination. I'd survived them before, but the classics never go out of style. I got to box in one piece, and no one so much as glared at me. I felt sort of rejected, but comforted myself with the knowledge that there were at least half a dozen people in town who were sure to keep making my life dangerous. More if you counted Mavra, who technically wasn't a person. Bach didn't open the doors of his store until 11, so when I went in, I was probably the first one to show up for the day. I paused outside the door. Two of the store windows and the glass panel of the door were all gone, replaced by rough sheets of plywood. Bach had gotten off better than the boutique next door. All the glass was gone, doubtless shattered by one kind of flying debris or another during my conversation with Cowell and his sidekick. I went inside. Bach was at his place behind the counter and looked tired. He glanced up at the sound of his door chimes. His expression became something closed and cautious when he saw me. Bach, I said, you here all night?
End of the month inventory, he said, his voice careful and quiet. And repairing the windows. What do you need?
I looked around the inside of the store. Sheila appeared from behind one of the shelves at the back of the store, looking anxious. She saw me and exhaled a little, then gave me a quiet smile.
Just here to talk, I told Bach, nodding toward Sheila.
He glanced at her, then back at me, frowning.
Dresden, there's something I need to say to you.
I arched an eyebrow at him. What's wrong?
Look, I don't want to make you upset.
I leaned on my staff.
Bach, come on. You've known me ever since I came to town. If something's wrong, you aren't going to upset me by telling me about it.
He folded his thick forearms over his paunch and said,
I don't want you coming into my store anymore.
I leaned on my staff a little more.
Oh. You're a decent enough man. You've never jumped down my throat like the other folks from the council. You've helped people around here.
He took a deep breath and made a vague gesture toward the plywood patches on his shop.
But you're trouble. It follows you around.
Which was true enough. I didn't say anything.
Not everyone can drop a car on someone who attacks them, Bach went on. I've got a family. My oldest is in college. I can't afford to have the place wrecked.
I nodded. I could understand Bach's position. It's terrifying to feel helpless in the face of a greater power. More so than it is painful to be told you aren't wanted somewhere.
Look, if you need anything, give me a call. I'll order it or pull it off the shelves for you. Will or Georgia can come pick it up, but...
Okay, I said. My throat felt a little tight. Bach's face got red. He looked away from me at the ruined door.
I'm sorry.
Don't be, I said. I understand. I'm sorry about your shop. He nodded.
I'm just here for a minute. After that, I'll go. Right, he said. I walked down the aisles back to Sheila and nodded to her. I got your message. Sheila was wearing the same clothes as the night before, only more rumpled. She'd pulled her hair back and held it in place with a pair of ballpoint pens thrust through a knot at right angles. With her hair like that, it showed the pale, clean lines of her jaw and throat, and I was again struck by the impulse to run my fingers over her skin and see if it was as soft as it looked. She glanced at Bach, then smiled up at me and touched my arm with her hand. I'm sorry he did that. It isn't fair of him. No, it's fair enough. He has the right to protect himself and his business, I said. I don't blame him. She tilted her head to one side, studying my face. But it hurts anyway? I shrugged. Some. I'll survive. The chimes rung at the front of the store as another customer came in. I glanced back at Bach and sighed. Look, I don't want to be here very long. What did you need? She brushed back a few strands of hair that had escaped the knot. Well, I had a strange experience last night. I lifted my eyebrows. Go on. She picked up a small stack of books and started shelving them as she spoke. After all the excitement, I went back to the inventory in the back room, and Mr. Bach had gone to get the plywood for the windows. I thought I heard the chimes ring, but when I looked, no one was there. Uh-huh, I said. But, she frowned, you know how when you go into an empty house, you know it's empty? How it just feels empty? Sure, I said. I watched her stretch up onto the tips of her toes to put a book away on the top shelf. It drew her sweater up a little, and I could see muscles move under a swath of the pale skin of her lower back. The store didn't feel empty, she said, and I saw her shiver. I never saw anyone, never heard anyone, but I was sure someone was here. She glanced back at me and flushed. I was so nervous I could hardly think straight until the sun came up. Then what? I asked. It went away. I felt a little silly, like I was a scared little kid, or one of those dogs that's staring at something growling when nothing is there. I shook my head. Dogs don't just stare and growl for no reason. Sometimes they can perceive things people can't. She frowned. Do you think something was here? I didn't want to tell her that I thought a black court vampire had been lurking unseen in the shop. Hell, for that matter, I didn't particularly want to think about it. If Mavra had been here, there wouldn't have been anything Sheila or Bach could do to defend themselves against her. I think you wouldn't be foolish to trust your instincts, I said. You've got a little talent. It's possible you were sensing something too vague for you to understand in any other way. She put the last book away and turned to face me. She looked tired. Fear made her expression one of sickness, an ugly contortion. Something was here, she whispered. Maybe, I said, nodding. Oh, God. She tightened her arms across her stomach. I might be sick. I leaned my staff against the shelf and put a hand on her shoulder, steadying her. Sheila, take a few deep breaths. It's not here now. She looked up at me, her expression miserable, her eyes wet and shining. I'm sorry. I mean, you don't need this. She squeezed her eyes tightly shut, and more tears fell. I'm sorry. Oh, hell. Tears. Way to go, Dresden. Terrify the local maiden you showed up to comfort. I drew Sheila a little toward me, and she leaned against me gratefully. I put my arm around her shoulders and let her lean against me for a minute. She shivered with silent tears for a little bit, and then pulled herself together. Does this happen to you a lot? She asked in a quiet voice, sniffling. People get scared, I murmured. There's nothing wrong with that. There are scary things out there.
I feel like a coward.
Don't, I told her. All it means is that you aren't an idiot. She straightened and took a step back. Her face looked a little blotchy. Some women can cry and look beautiful, but Sheila wasn't one of them. She took off her glasses and wiped at her eyes.
What do I do if it happens again?
Tell Bach. Get somewhere public, I said. Call the cops. Or better yet, call Billy in Georgia. If what you felt really was some kind of predator, they won't want to stick around if they know they've been spotted.
You sound as if you've dealt with them before, she said.
I smiled a little.
Maybe a time or two.
She smiled up at me, and it was a grateful expression.
It must be very lonely, doing what you do.
Sometimes, I said.
Always being so strong when others can't. That's, well, it's sort of heroic.
It's sort of idiotic, I replied, my voice dry. Heroism doesn't pay very well. I try to be cold-blooded and money-oriented, but I keep screwing it up. She let out a little laugh.
You fail to live up to your ideals, eh?
Nobody's perfect. She tilted her head again, eyes bright.
Are you with someone?
Just you.
Not with them. With them.
Oh, I said. No, not really.
If I asked you to come have dinner out with me, would it seem too forward and aggressive?
I blinked. You mean like a date? Her smile widened.
You do, you know, like women, right?
What? I asked. Oh, yes, yes, I'm down with the women.
By coincidence, I happen to be a woman, she said.
She touched my arm again.
And since it seems like I might not get a chance to flirt with you a little more while I'm at work, I thought I had better ask you now. So, is that a yes?
The prospect of a date seemed to me like a case of bad timing in several ways, but it also seemed like a good idea. I mean, it had been a while since a girl had been interested in me in a non-professional sense. Well, a human girl, anyway. The only one who even came close was in Hawaii with someone else, giggling and thinking about pants. It might be really nice just to be out talking and interacting with an attractive girl. God knows it would beat hanging around my crowded apartment. It's a yes, I said. I'm kind of busy right now, but...
Here, she said.
She took a black marker out of a pocket in her sweater and grabbed my right hand. She wrote numbers on it in heavy black strokes.
Call me here, maybe tonight, and we'll figure out when.
I let her do it, amused. All right. She popped the cap back on the marker and smiled up at me.
All right, then.
I picked up my staff. Sheila, look, I might not be around this place. I'll respect Bach's wishes. But let him know that if there's any trouble, all he has to do is call me. She shook her head, smiling.
You're a decent person, Harry Dresden.
Don't spread that around too much, I said, and started for the door. And froze in my tracks. Standing in the little entry area of the bookstore, facing Bach at his counter, were Alicia and the ghoul, Lee Xian. I stepped back to Sheila and pulled her around the corner of a shelf.
What is it? She asked.
Quiet, I said. I closed my eyes and listened.
A simple question, Alicia was saying. Who bought it?
I don't keep track of my customers, Bach replied. His voice was polite, but it had an undertone of granite. I'm sorry, but I just don't have that information. A lot of people come through here.
Really? Alicia asked. And how many of them purchase rare and expensive antique books from you?
You'd be surprised.
Alicia let out a nasty little laugh.
You really aren't going to volunteer the information, are you?
I don't have it to volunteer, Bach said. Both copies of the book were bought yesterday. Both were men, one older and one younger. I don't remember anything more than that.
I heard a couple of footsteps, and Lee Xian said,
Perhaps you need help remembering.
There was the distinct heavy click of a pair of hammers on a shotgun being drawn back. Son, Bach said in that same voice, you will want to step away from the counter and leave my shop, now.
It would appear that the good shopkeeper has taken sides on this matter, Alicia said.
You're wrong, miss, Bach said. I run this shop. I don't give information. I don't take sides.
If I had a third copy, I'd sell it to you. I don't. Both of you leave. Please.
I don't think you understand, Alicia said. I'm not leaving here until I have an answer to my question.
I don't think you understand, Bach replied. There's a 10-gauge shotgun wired under this counter. It's loaded, cocked, and pointing right at your bellies.
Oh, my, Alicia said, her voice amused. A shotgun? Gian, whatever shall we do?
I ground my teeth. Bach had asked me to stay away, but even so, he was standing there protecting my identity, even though he knew damn well that the two in front of him were dangerous. I checked. The door to the back room of the shop was open.
The back door, I said to Sheila in a whisper. Is it locked?
Not from this side.
Go into the back room and get in the office, I said. Get on the floor and stay there. Now.
She looked up at me with wide eyes and then hurried back through the open door. I gripped my staff and closed my eyes, thinking. I patted my duster's pocket. The book was still there, riding along with my .44. Ghouls were hard to kill. I had no idea what Alicia was, but I was willing to bet she wasn't a mere academic assistant. For her to command the respect of a creature like Li Xian, she had to be major league dangerous. It would be an extremely foolish idea to assault them. But that didn't matter. If I didn't do something, they were going to get unpleasant at Bach. Bach might not have been a stalwart companion who stuck through thick and thin, but he was what he was, an honest shopkeeper who wanted neither to become involved in supernatural power struggles nor to compromise his principles. If I did nothing, he was going to get hurt while protecting me. I stepped around the shelf and started walking toward the front of the store. Bach sat in his spot behind the counter, one hand gripping its edge in a white-knuckled grasp, the other out of sight below it. Alicia and Li Xian stood in front of it. She looked relaxed. The ghoul was slouched into an eager stance, knees bent a little, arms hanging loosely.
"Shopkeeper, I will ask you one last time," Alicia said. "Who purchased the last copy of Die Lied der Erlking?"
She lifted her left hand, and faint heat shimmers rose from her fingers, along with a whisper of dark power.
"Tell me his name."
I drew in my will, lifted my staff, and snarled.
Forzare!
The runes on the staff burst into smoldering scarlet light. There was a thunderstorm's roar, and raw power, invisible and solid, lashed out of the end of my staff. It whipped across the shop, knocking books from the shelves on the way, and hit the ghoul in the chest. It lifted him off his feet and sent him smashing into the plywood-covered door. He went through the wood without slowing down, out over the sidewalk and into the wall of the building across the street, where he hit with a crunch. Alicia spun toward me, her eyes wide and shocked. I stood with my feet spread. My shield bracelet was on my left hand, thrumming with power and drizzling blue-white sparks. My staff smoldered with the scent of fresh-burned wood, and the scarlet runes shone in the darkness at the back of the store. I pointed it directly at Alicia.
"His name," I snarled, "is Harry Dresden."
Chapter 17.
"You," I snarled, gesturing at Bach with the end of my staff. "You little weasel! You were going to sell me out. I ought to kill you right here."
From his vantage point above Alicia's curly-haired head, Bach blinked at me in confusion. I stared at him hard, not daring to leave anything in my expression that the girl would see. If I'd tried to protect Bach, it would only have made it more likely that she would do something to him. By appearing to threaten him, it would make him seem more unimportant to the necromancer and her henchmen. It was the best thing I could do to protect him. Bach got it. His expression flickered through several subtle shades of comprehension, fear, and guilt. He twitched his head at me in a nod of thanks.
"Well, well," Alicia said.
She hadn't moved other than to turn toward me.
"I've never heard of you, but I must admit that you know how to make an entrance, Harry Dresden."
I took lessons, I said.
Give me the book, she said.
Ha! I said. Why?
Because I want it, she said.
Sorry, it's the hot Christmas present this year, I said. Maybe you can find a scalper in a parking lot or something. She tilted her head, the fingers of her hand still flickering with little shimmers, like heat rising from asphalt.
You refuse?
Yes, Moppet, I told her. I refuse. I deny thee. No, already. Her eyes narrowed in anger and, well, something happened that I hadn't ever seen before. The store got darker. I don't mean that the lights went out. I mean everything got darker. There was a low, trembling sensation that seemed to make my eyeballs jiggle a little, and the shadows simply expanded up out of the corners and dim areas of the store, like time-lapse photography of growing molds. As they slid over portions of the store, that nasty, greasy sensation of cold came with them. When the shadows washed over an outlet that housed the power cords to a pair of table lamps, the lamps themselves went dim and then died out. They covered the old radio, and Aretha Franklin's voice faded away to a whisper and vanished. The shadows got to the register, and its lights went out. And when they brushed the old ceiling fan, it began to whirl down to a stop. The shadows crept over Bach, and he went pale and started shaking. He thrust one hand down onto the counter, as if he had to do it to keep himself upright. The only place the darkness didn't spread was over me. The shadows stopped in a circle all around me, maybe 6 inches away from me and the things I was carrying. The hellfire smoldering in the ruins of my staff glowed more brightly in the darkness, and the tiny sparks falling in a steady rain from my damaged shield bracelet seemed to burn away tiny pockets of the darkness where they fell, only to have it slide back in once they had burned away. This was a kind of power I hadn't felt before. Normally, when someone who can sling Major Mojo around draws their stuff up around them, it's something violent and active. I'd seen wizards who charged the air around them with so much electricity it made their hair stand on end. Wizards whose power would gather light into nearly solid gem-shaped clouds that orbited around them. Wizards whose mastery of earth magic literally made the ground shake. Wizards who could shroud themselves in dark fire that burned anyone near them with the raw, emotional rage of their magic. This was different. Alicia's power, whatever it was, didn't fill the store. It emptied it in a way that I didn't think I fully understood. Utter stillness spread out from her. Not peace, for that would have been something tranquil, accepting. This stillness was a horrible, hungry emptiness, something that took its power from being not. It was made of the emptiness at the loss of a loved one, of the silence between the beats of a heart, and of the inevitability of the empty void that waited patiently for the stars to grow cold and burn out. It was power wholly different from the burning fires of life that formed the magic I knew. And it was strong. God, it was so strong. I began to tremble as I realized that everything I had wasn't enough to go up against this.
I don't like your answer, Alicia said.
She smiled at me, a slow and evil expression. She had a dimple on one cheek. Hell's bells, an evil dimple. My mouth felt dry, but my voice sounded steady when I spoke.
That's too bad. If you're so upset about not getting a copy, I suggest you take it up with Cowell.
She stared at me with no expression for a moment, and then said,
You are with Cowell?
No, I told her. I was, in fact, forced to drop a car on him last night when he tried to take the book from me.
Liar, she said. Had you truly fought Cowell, you'd be dead.
Whatever, I replied, my tone bored. I'll tell you what I told him. My book. You can't have it. She pursed her lips thoughtfully.
Wait a moment. You were at the mortuary, in the entryway.
We call it the Forensic Institute now. Her eyes glittered.
You found it. You succeeded where Gravain failed, didn't you?
I turned up one corner of my mouth and said nothing. Alicia took in a deep breath.
Perhaps we can reach an understanding.
Funny, I said. Gravain said the very same thing. Alicia took an eager step toward me.
You denied him?
I didn't like his hat.
You have wisdom for one so young, she said. In the end, he is nothing but a dog mourning his fallen master. He would turn on you in a moment. The gratitude of the Capio Corpus, by contrast, is an eternal asset.
Capio Corpus. Roughly translated, the taker of corpses, or bodies. I suddenly had a better idea of why Li Xian had referred to Alicia as my lord.
Assuming I want that gratitude, I said, what price would it carry?
Give me the book, she said. Give me the word. Stand with me at the Dark Hallow. In exchange, I will grant you autonomy and the principality of your choice when the new order arises.
I didn't want her to know that I had no freaking clue what she was talking about, so I said, that's a tempting offer.
It should be, she said.
She lifted her chin, and her eyes glittered with something bright and utterly confident.
The new order will change many things in this world. You have the opportunity to help shape it to your liking.
And if I turn you down? I asked. She met my eyes directly.
You are young, Harry Dresden. It is a great tragedy when a man with your potential dies before his time.
I shied away from her gaze at once. When a wizard looks into another person's eyes for an instant too long, he sees into them in a profound and unsettling kind of vision called a soul gaze. If I'd left my gaze on Alicia's eyes, I would get an up-close and personal look at her soul, and she at mine. I didn't want to see what was going on behind that dimpled smile. I recognized that perfect surety in her manner and expression as something more than rampant ego or fanatic conviction. It was pure madness. Whatever else Alicia was, she was calmly and horribly insane. My mouth felt a lot drier. My legs were shaking, and my feet were advising the rest of me to let them run away. I'll have to think about it.
By all means, Alicia said. Her face took on an ugly expression, and her voice hardened. Consider it, but take a single step from where you stand, and it will be your last.
Killing me might get you a copy of the book, but it won't get you the word, I said. Or did you think I was carrying both of them around with me?
Her right hand clenched into a slow fist, and the room got a couple of degrees colder.
Where is the word?
Wouldn't I like to know, I thought.
Wouldn't you like to know, I said. Kill me now and there's no word, no new order.
She uncurled her hand.
I can make you tell me, she said.
If you could do that, you'd have done it by now, instead of standing there looking stupid.
She started taking slow steps toward me, smiling.
I prefer to attempt reason before I destroy a mind. It is a somewhat taxing activity. Are you sure you wouldn't rather work with me?
Gulp. Mental magic is a dark, dark, dark gray area of the art. Every wizard who makes it to the White Council has received training in how to defend against mental assaults, but that was perfunctory at best. After all, the Council made it a special point to wipe out wizards who violated the sanctuary of another's mind. It's one of the laws of magic, and if the wardens caught someone doing it, they killed them. End of story. There was no such thing as an expert at that kind of magic on the White Council, and as a result, the defense training was devised by relative amateurs. Something told me that Alicia the Corpse Taker wasn't an amateur.
That's close enough, I said in a cold voice.
She kept walking, very slowly, a sort of sinuous enjoyment in her stride.
Last chance.
I mean it, I said. Stay back.
Before I could finish the word, She made a rippling gesture with the shimmering fingers of her left hand. There was a whirling sensation, and I was suddenly caught in a gale, a whirlwind that tried to carry me toward the girl. My feet started sliding across the floor. I leaned back with a cry, lifting my shield bracelet, and it blazed into a dome of solid blue light before me. It did nothing. Nothing at all. The vicious vortex continued to draw me to her outstretched hand. I started to panic, and then realized what was happening. There was no wind, not physically anyway. The books on the shelves were not stirring, nor was my long leather duster. My shield offered me no protection from a wholly non-physical threat, and I released it, saving my strength. The hideous vacuum wasn't meant for my body. It was targeting my thoughts.
"That's right," Alicia said.
"Holy crap," she'd heard me thinking.
"Of course, young man. Give me what I want now, and I may leave you enough of your mind to feed yourself."
I gritted my teeth, marshaling my thoughts, my defenses.
"It's too late for that, boy."
Like hell it was. My thoughts coalesced into a unified whole, an absolute image of a wall of smooth gray granite. I built the image of the wall in my mind, and then filled it with the power I'd been holding at the ready. I felt a nauseating confusion for a second, and then the mental gale ceased as abruptly as it had begun. Alicia's head jerked as if she'd been slapped across the cheek. I glared at her, teeth gritted, and asked, "Is that all you got?" Corpse Taker snarled out a spiteful curse, lifted her left arm, and twisted her fingers into a raking claw. There was a hideous pressure against the image of the granite wall in my mind. It wasn't a single resounding blow, as I'd expected from my training, a kind of psychic battering ram. Instead, it was an enormous, steady weight, as if a sudden tide had flooded in to wash the wall away completely. I thought that pressure would ease in a moment, but it only became more and more difficult to bear. I struggled to hold the image of the wall in place, but despite everything I could do, dark and empty cracks began to appear and spread through it. My defenses were crumbling.
"Delicious," Corpse Taker said,
and her voice didn't sound strained at all.
"After a century, they're still teaching the young ones the same tripe."
I saw movement beyond Corpse Taker, and Li Xian appeared in the shattered plywood doorway. Half of his face was lumpy and purpled with bruising, and one shoulder had been smashed grossly out of shape. He was bleeding a thin, greenish-brown fluid, and moved as if in great pain. But he came in on his own power, and his eyes were alert.
"My lord," Xian said, "are you well?"
"Perfectly," Corpse Taker purred. "Once I have his mind, the rest is yours."
His misshapen face twisted into a smile that spread too wide for human features.
"Thank you, Lord."
Holy crap. It was time to leave. But my feet wouldn't move.
"You needn't bother, young wizard," Corpse Taker said. "If you take the attention you would need to free your feet, your wall will fail. Just open to me, boy. You will feel less pain."
I ignored the necromancer and tried to think of other options. My mental defenses were indeed crumbling, but any strength of will I spent to move my legs would collapse the defenses entirely. I had to get the pressure off of me for a moment, only time enough to distract Corpse Taker, to give me time to get the hell away. But given that I could barely move at all, my options were severely limited. Part of the wall began to crumble. I felt Corpse Taker's will begin pouring in, the first trickle from a dark sea. If I wanted to live, I had little choice. I reached my thoughts down into the smoldering hellfire burning in the ruins of my staff, and sent it flooding into my mind, into the failing wall that protected me. The cracks in the cold gray granite filled with crimson flame, and with a dark sea of Corpse Taker's will pressed against it, there was a screaming hiss of freezing water boiling into a cloud of steam. Corpse Taker let out a sudden, hollow gasp, and the pressure on my thoughts vanished. I spun,
wobbled, got my balance, and then ran for the back door.
"Take him!"
Corpse Taker snarled behind me.
"He has the book and the word!"
There was a sickly, ripping, crackling sound, and Li Xian let out a bestial and inhuman howl. I dashed through the back room of the bookstore and to the back door. I slammed its opening bar and sprinted through it, out into the alley behind the shop. I heard two sets of feet following me, and Corpse Taker began chanting in a low, growling voice. That hideous pressure began to surge against my thoughts again, but this time I was ready for it, and my defenses fell into place more quickly, more surely. I was able to keep running. I ran down the alley and made it maybe 30 yards before a sudden fire exploded through my right calf. I crashed down to the ground, barely holding on to my mental defenses. I dropped my staff and reached down to my calf to feel something metal and sharp protruding from it. I cut my fingers on an edge and jerked them back. I couldn't get a good look, but I saw a flash of steel and a lot of blood, and Corpse Taker and the ghoul were still coming. There was no way I could have whipped up any magic to stop them, not with all of my power focused on keeping Corpse Taker from invading my mind. I wouldn't be able to overcome the ghoul physically. Even wounded, Xian was quick on his feet and closing the distance fast. I drew the .44 and sent 3 shots back down the alley. Corpse Taker darted to one side, but the ghoul never even slowed down. He flung one too-long arm through an arc, and there was a glitter of steel in the gloomy alley. Something hit me in the ribs, nearly hard enough to knock me down, but the spell-covered leather of my duster stopped it from piercing through. A triangle of steel fell to the ground, each point sharpened and given a razor's edge. "All I needed," I muttered. "Ninja ghouls." I emptied the revolver at Xian. He wasn't 10 feet from me on the last shot, and I must have hit him. He jerked, careened off a wall, and stumbled, but he was a long way from down. Corpse Taker's will continued to erode my defenses. I had to get away from her, or she'd open up my brains like a tin of sardines, and then Xian would eat them. The 3-pointed shuriken still in my calf, I forced myself to my feet through the screaming pain. I seized my staff, hobbling in earnest this time, and struggled toward the end of the alley. My only chance was to make it to the street, to flag down a cab, somehow beg a ride from a passing car, or maybe get some help. I knew there wasn't much hope of any of those things happening, but it was all I had. I almost got to the end of the alley, the pain in my leg growing steadily worse, and then I abruptly lost track of what was going on. One moment I'd been busy, I knew. I was doing something important. The next, I was just standing there, sort of floundering. Whatever I'd been doing, it was right on the tip of my tongue. I knew that if I could just focus for a second, I'd be able to remember it and get back on track. My leg hurt, I knew that. And my head felt jumbled, the thoughts there but in disarray, as if I'd gone through a drawer of folded laundry, pulled out something from the bottom, and then slapped the drawer shut again without straightening anything up. I heard a snarl behind me, and realized that whatever I'd been doing, it was too late to get back on track now. I tried to turn around, but for some reason, I couldn't remember how.
"I have it," panted a woman's voice behind me. "Numbers. It's only... he only has numbers."
"My lord," snarled a thick, deformed voice. "What is your command?"
"He doesn't know where the word is. He's useless to me. The book is in the right pocket of his coat. Take it, Xian. Then kill him."
Chapter 18. I was pretty sure that Corpse Taker was talking about me, and I knew for sure that getting killed was a bad thing. I just couldn't figure out how to go about doing something to stop it. Something about my mind, that it wasn't working right. A battered-looking man entered my field of view, and I was able to turn my head enough to watch him. Oh, crap. It was Li Xian, the ghoul. I had a bad feeling that he was going to do something unpleasant, but he just stuck his hand in my coat pocket and pulled out the slender copy of Earl King. The ghoul turned away from me and offered the book to someone out of my field of view. There was the sound of flipping pages.
"Excellent," Corpse Taker said. "Take him back from the street and finish him.
Hurry. He's stronger than most. I'd rather not hold him all day.
Oh, right. Corpse Taker was holding my mind captive. That meant that she was in my head. That meant she had beaten my defenses down. Just pulling those thoughts together made me feel stronger. My head started clearing, and as it did, the pain in my wounded leg grew more intense.
Hurry,
she said, her voice now strained. Rough hands seized the back of my coat. I wanted to run, but I still couldn't get everything to respond together. An inspiration seized me. If Corpse Taker was in my head, it meant that she could feel everything I was feeling, such as the burning pain in my leg. When the ghoul started pulling me backward, I couldn't struggle, but I managed to twist my hips a little and bend my good knee. I fell over sideways onto the wounded leg. The fall drove the shuriken a little harder into my calf, and the world went white with pain. Corpse Taker shrieked. I heard a metallic clatter as if she had stumbled into a trash can, and I felt my arms and legs come all the way back under my command. The ghoul stumbled on his mangled leg. He pushed off the wall and came at me. I spun on the small of my back and kicked out hard and straight at his good knee. That's a nasty defensive technique Murphy taught me, and one that doesn't rely upon raw physical power. The ghoul's weight was all on that leg, and the kick connected hard. There was a grinding pop, and he let out a splitting snarl of pain. I scrambled away from him on one leg and the heels of my hands. I could see my blood on the floor of the alley, smeared in a trail from my wounded leg. There were little stars fluttering through my vision, and I felt as weak as a starved kitten. Everything was spinning around so much that I didn't even bother to get to my feet. I crawled out of the cold shadows of the alley, onto the sidewalk, and into broad daylight. I heard someone shout something. There were police sirens a block or two away. They were doubtless heading for Bach's place, after someone had seen me throw the ghoul out through the plywood-covered door. Give them 2 minutes to sort out what was going on, and I'd have men with silver shields and a strong desire to speak to the dead professor's missing assistants all around me. Of course, by then, I'd probably have been dead for a minute and a half. The wounded ghoul, his face twisted, jaws lolling open wide to show yellowed fangs, came shambling out of the alley after me. I heard a woman shout, the sound high and furious and totally unafraid. There was a whooshing sound, a spinning shape, and then an axe, a freaking double-bladed axe, buried itself to the eye in the ghoul's flank. Just as it hit, there was a flash of light from a spot on the blade, so bright that it left a red mark in the shape of a single rune burned into my vision. There was a loud bark of sound as the axe hit the ghoul. The creature was thrown forcefully to the sidewalk, and thin, greenish-brown fluid sprayed everywhere in a disgusting shower. A woman in a dark business suit stepped into my line of sight. She was better than 6 feet tall, blonde, and coldly beautiful. Her blue eyes burned with battle lust and excitement as she drew a sword with a straight 3-foot blade from the scabbard at her side. As I watched, she took several smooth steps to place herself between the ghoul and me. Then she pointed the tip of the sword at him and snarled,
"Avant, carrion!"
The ghoul tore the axe from his side and staggered into a crouch, holding the weapon in both hands with a panicked desperation. He took a pair of awkward, shuffling steps back. An engine roared and a gray sedan swerved up onto the sidewalk.
"Avant!"
cried the woman. Then she raised the sword and glided toward the ghoul. Li Xian didn't want any part of it. His inhuman face twisted in recognizable fear. He dropped the axe and fled back down the alley.
"Coward," the woman sighed, clearly disappointed.
She snatched up the axe, then said to me,
"Get in."
"I know you," I said. "Miss Guard, you work for Marcone." "I work for Monarch Securities," the woman corrected me. Her hand clamped down on my arm like a slender steel vise, and she hauled me to my feet without effort. My wounded calf clenched into a nasty cramp, and I could feel the steel blades continuing to cut at my muscles. I clenched my teeth, snarling my defiance at the pain. guard gave me a quick glance of approval and tugged me toward the gray sedan. I still had to hobble on my staff, but with her help, I made it to the car and fumbled my way into the back seat. More hands pulled me in. The whole time, guard kept her sharp, cold blue gaze on the alley and the street around us. Once I was in, she shut the door, sheathed the sword, and unclipped the scabbard from her belt before getting into the passenger's seat. The gray sedan pulled out into the street again and started away from the scene. The driver turned his head just enough to catch me in his peripheral vision. His neck was too thick for any more movement than that. He had red hair clipped into a close buzz, shoulders wide enough to build a deck on, and he'd had to get his business suit at the Big and Tall store. "Hendricks," I greeted him. He looked up into the rearview mirror with his beady eyes and glowered. "Nice to see you again, too," I said. I settled back into the seat as much as I could, trying to ignore my leg, and refusing to look at the man sitting beside me. I didn't really need to look at him. He was a man a little over average height, somewhere in the late prime of his life, his dark hair flecked with gray. He had skin that had seen a lot of time out in the weather, leaving him with a perpetual boater's tan and eyes the color of wrinkled old dollars. He'd be wearing a suit that cost more than some cars and making it look good. He looked handsome and wholesome, more like the coach of a successful sports team than a gangster. But John Marcone was the most powerful figure in Chicago's criminal underworld. "Isn't that a little childish?" he asked me, his voice amused. "Refusing to look at me like that?" "Indulge me," I said. "It's been a long day." "How serious is your injury?" he asked. "Do I look like a doctor to you?" I asked. "You look more like a corpse," he answered. I squinted at him. He sat calmly in his seat, mirroring me. "Is that a threat?" I asked. "If I wanted you dead," Marcone said, "I would hardly have come to your aid just now. You must admit, Dresden, that I have just saved your life. Again." I closed my eye again and scowled. "Your timing is improbable." He sounded amused. "In what way?" "Coming to my rescue just as someone was about to punch my ticket. You must admit, Marcone, that smells like a setup." "Even I occasionally enjoy good fortune," he replied. I shook my head. "I called you less than an hour ago. If it wasn't a setup, then how did you find me?" "He didn't," said guard. "I did." She looked over her shoulder at Marcone and frowned. "This is a mistake. It was his fate to die in that alley." "What is the point of having free will if one cannot occasionally spit in the eye of destiny?" Marcone asked. "There will be consequences," she insisted. Marcone shrugged. "When aren't there?" Guard turned her face back to the front and shook her head. "Hubris. Mortals never understand." "Tell me about it," I said. "Everyone makes that mistake but me." Marcone glanced at me and his eyes wrinkled at the corners. It was very nearly a smile. Guard turned her head slowly and gave me a cold glare that wasn't anywhere close to smiling. "Let's get to the part of the conversation where you tell me what you want," I said. "I don't have time for any more banter." "Ah," Marcone said. "I suspected you would somehow become involved in the events at hand." "What events would those be?" I asked. "The situation concerning the death of Tony Mendoza." I scowled at him. "What do you want?" "Unless I miss my guess," Marcone said, "I want to help you." "Yeah," I said, "right." "I'm quite serious, Dresden," he told me. "I allow no one to harm those in my employ. Whoever murdered Mendoza must be chastised immediately, whether or not they happen to be necromancers." I blinked. "How did you know what they were?" "Miss Guard," he replied serenely. "She and her colleagues have outstanding resources." I shrugged.
"Good for you, but I'm not interested in helping you maintain your empire."
"Naturally, but you are interested in stopping these men and women before they accomplish whatever goal it is that they are pursuing." I shrugged.
"You don't know that."
"Yes, I do," he said, his tone growing distant and cool. He met my eyes and said, "Because I know you. I know that you would oppose them, just as you know that I will not permit them to take one of mine from me without punishment." I glared back at him. I wasn't worried about a soul gaze. Those happened only once between any two people, and Marcone had already gotten a look at me. When he said that he knew me, that's what he was talking about. I'd seen his soul in return, and it had been a cold and barren place, but one of order as well. If Marcone gave his word, he kept it. And if someone came for one of his people, he would go after them without hesitation, fear, or pity. That didn't make him noble. Marcone had the soul of a tiger, of a predator protecting his territory. It only made him more resolved and more dangerous.
"I'm not a hitman," I told him, "and I don't work for you."
"Nor am I asking you to," he said. "I simply want to give you information that might help you in your efforts."
"You aren't listening. I am not going to kill anyone for you."
His teeth suddenly showed, very white against the tan. "But you will go up against them."
"Yes."
He settled back in his seat. "I've seen what you do to the people who get in your way. I'm willing to take my chances." That thought, that attitude, was a little creepier than I was comfortable with. I wasn't a killer. I mean, sure, sometimes I fought. Sometimes people and not people got killed. But it wasn't as though I was some kind of Jack the Ripper. From time to time, matters got desperately dangerous between me and various denizens of the preternatural world. But I had only killed... I thought about it for a minute. I'd killed more of them than I hadn't. Quite a few more. I felt a little sick to my stomach. Marcone watched me from behind hooded eyes and waited.
"What do you want to tell me?" I asked him.
"I don't want to waste your time," he said. "Ask me questions. I'll answer whichever I can."
"How much do you know about the deal that got Mendoza killed?"
He drummed the fingers of his right hand on his thigh for a moment. "Mendoza was getting ready to retire," Marcone said. "He had a final scheme to complete. I owed the man for loyalties past, and at his request, I allowed him certain liberties." "He was selling something independently?" Marcone nodded. "The contents of an old storage locker. Mendoza had come across the key to it in an estate sale." That was criminal speak for purchasing hot merchandise from a mugger or burglar. "Go on." "The key opened a storage locker that had been sealed since 1945. It contained a number of works of art, jewelry, and similar cultural artifacts." I arched an eyebrow. "Loot from World War II?"
"So Mendoza presumed," Marcone said.
"He offered me my selection of the contents, and in return, I allowed him to dispose of the rest in whatever manner he saw fit."
"What did you get out of it?" I asked.
"Two Monets and a Van Gogh."
"Holy crap," I shook my head. "What happened then?"
"Mendoza went about liquidating his cash. It had been in process for several weeks when he reported that one of the people he had approached regarding an antique book seemed to have access to resources that were well beyond the ordinary."
"Did he give you a name?" I asked.
"A man named Gravain," Marcone said. "Mendoza asked for my advice on the matter."
"And you told him about how wizards are technologically challenged?"
"Among other things," he said, nodding.
"But the deal went south."
"So it would seem," Marcone said. "Since Mendoza's death, I have asked Miss Guard to collect information on recent events in the local supernatural community." I glanced at the woman and nodded.
"And she told you there were necromancers running around?"
"Once that had been established, we attempted to narrow down the location of these individuals, particularly Gravain, but met with very limited success." "I'm able to find out where they've been," Guard said without turning around, "or at least where they've been weaving their spells."
"And there are a number of hot spots of necromantic energy around town," I said. "I know that already."
Marcone placed his fingers in a steeple before him. But what I suspect you do not know is that last night, at the location on Wacker, a member of my organization had an altercation with representatives of a rival interest from out of town. There was a gunfight. My man was mortally wounded and left for dead.
That doesn't add up to necromancy, I said, frowning. What caused the hot spot?
That is the question, Marcone said. He took a folded piece of paper from his breast pocket and passed it to me. These are the names of the responding EMTs, he said. According to my man, they were the first on the scene.
Did he talk to you before he died? I asked.
He did, Marcone replied. In point of fact, he did not die.
Thought you said he was mortally wounded.
He was, Mr. Dresden, Marcone said, his features remote. He was. He survived. The surgeons at Cook County thought it a bona fide miracle. Naturally, I thought of you at once. I rubbed at my chin.
What else has he said?
Nothing, Marcone said. He has no memory of the events after he saw the ambulance arriving.
So you want me to talk to the EMTs? Why haven't you done it yourself? I asked.
He arched his brows. Dresden, try to keep in mind that I am a criminal. For some reason, it's quite difficult to get people in uniforms to open their hearts to me. I gritted my teeth at another agonizing twinge from my leg.
Right.
So, he said, we're back to my original question. How serious is your injury?
I'll make it, I said.
Do you think you'll need to see a doctor? If it's too mild a wound, I'll be glad to have Miss Gard make it look more authentic. I looked at him for a moment. I'm heading for an emergency room, whether I need it or not, huh? As luck would have it, we are near a hospital. Cook County, in fact.
Yeah, the cut's pretty deep.
I looked at the piece of paper and then stuck it in my pocket.
There's bound to be an EMT or two there. Maybe you should drop me off at the emergency room.
Marcone smiled, and it didn't touch his eyes. Very well, Dresden. You have my deepest sympathies for your pain. Chapter 19. Marcone and company dropped me off 100 yards from the emergency entrance to the hospital, and I had to hobble in alone. It was hard, and I was tired, but I'd been hurt worse before. It wasn't like I wanted to do this every day or anything, but after a certain point of ridiculous discomfort, the pain all feels pretty much the same. Once I made it to the emergency room, I was a big hit. When you drag yourself inside panting and leaving a trail of bloody footprints behind you, it makes a certain impression. I had an orderly and a nurse helping me onto my stomach on a gurney within a few seconds while the nurse examined the wound.
It isn't life-threatening, she reported after she cut away my pant leg and took a look.
She glanced at me almost in accusation.
From the way you came in here, you'd think this almost killed you.
Well, I said, I'm kind of a wimp.
Nasty, commented the burly orderly. He produced a clipboard layered in forms and a ballpoint pen and handed them both to me.
I'll have to cut this out.
We'll let the doctor decide that, the nurse said. How did this happen, sir?
I have no clue, I said. I was walking down the street, and all of a sudden I thought my leg was on fire.
You walked here? She asked.
A helpful Boy Scout brought me most of the way, I said.
She sighed.
Well, it's been a slow day. I should be able to see you shortly.
That's super, I said, because it hurts like hell.
I can get you some Tylenol, the nurse said primly.
I don't have a headache. I have a 4-inch piece of steel in my leg.
She passed me a paper cup and 2 little white tablets. I sighed and took them.
Heh, the orderly said after she left. Don't worry too much. They'll get you something when the doctor sees to you.
With this kind of loving care, I probably won't need it.
Don't be too hard on her, the orderly said. You should see what people try so they can get some painkillers. Vicodin, morphine, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I said. Hey, man, can I ask you something?
Sure.
He had brought a bowl of ice with him, and he started sealing it into plastic bags, which he started packing around my leg.
This should numb it a little, and maybe take down some of the swelling. It ain't a local, but it's what I've got.
The ice didn't actually burst into steam upon touching me. even though it felt like it should have. The pain didn't exactly lessen, but it did suddenly feel a little more distant.
Thanks, man. Hey, I was hoping I could talk to a couple of guys I know while I was here, I said. They're EMTs, Gary Simmons and Jason Lamar.
The orderly lifted his eyebrows.
Simmons and Lamar, sure. They drive an ambulance.
I know. Are they around?
They were on shift last night, he said. But it's the end of the month and they might be on their swing shift. I'll ask.
Appreciate it, I said. If Simmons is there, tell him a school buddy is here.
Sure. If I do that, though, you gotta do something for me and fill out these forms.
I eyed the clipboard and picked up the pen. Tell the doc to sign me up for carpal tunnel surgery when he gets that thing out of me. Two birds with one stone. The orderly grinned. I'll do that. He left me to fill in forms, which didn't use to take terribly long to fill out since I didn't have any kind of insurance. One of these days, when I had the money, I was going to have to get some. They say that when you pay for insurance, you're really buying peace of mind. It might make me feel more peaceful to think how much money the company was probably going to lose on me in the long run. If I lived my whole life in the open, as I had been since I'd come to Chicago, they might be dealing with me for 2 or 3 centuries. I wondered what the yearly markup would be for a 250-year-old. A young doctor came in after I was finished with the forms, and true to the orderly's prediction, he had to cut the shuriken out of me. I got a local, and the sudden cessation of pain was like a drug all by itself. I fell asleep while he was cutting, and woke up as he was wrapping my leg up.
The suture's dry, he was saying, though from the looks of your file, I suppose you know that. Sure, Doc, I said. I know the drill. Do you need to take them out, or did I get the other kind?
They'll dissolve, he said, but if you experience any swelling or fever, get in touch. I'm giving you a prescription for something for the pain and some antibiotics.
Follow all the printed instructions and be sure to take them all, I said in my best surgeon general slash television announcer voice.
Looks like you've done this as often as I have, he said. He gestured to the steel tray where the bloodied shuriken lay. Did you want to keep the weapon?
Might as well. I'll have to get a souvenir in the gift shop otherwise.
You sure you don't want the police to look at it, he said. They might be able to find fingerprints or something.
I already told you guys it must have been some kind of accident, I said.
He gave me a look of extreme skepticism.
All right, if that's the way you want it.
He dropped the little weapon into a metal tray of alcohol or some other sterilizer.
Keep your leg elevated. That will ease the swelling. Stay off of it for a couple of days at least.
No problem, I said. He shook his head.
The orderly will be by in a minute with your prescriptions and a form to sign.
He departed. A minute later, there were footsteps outside the little alcove they put me in, and a large young man drew the curtain aside. He had skin almost as dark as my leather duster, and his hair had been cropped into a flat top so precise that his barber must have used a level. He was on the heavy side, not out of shape or ripped out, but simply large and comfortable with it. He wore an EMT's jacket, and the name tag on it read Lamar. He stood there looking at me for a minute, and then said,
"You're the wrong color to have been in my high school, and I didn't do college."
"Army medic?" I asked.
"Navy. Marines." He folded his arms.
"What do you want?"
"My name is Harry Dresden," I said.
He shrugged.
"But what do you want?"
I sat up. My leg was still blissfully numb.
"I wanted to talk to you about last night."
He eyed me warily.
"What about it?"
"You were on the team who responded to a gunshot victim on Wacker." His breath left him in a long exhale. He looked up and down the row, then stepped into the little alcove and closed the curtain behind him. He lowered his voice.
"So?"
"So I want you to tell me about it," I said.
He shook his head. "Look, I want to keep my job."
I lowered my voice as well.
"You think telling me is going to endanger that?"
"Maybe," he said. He pulled open his jacket and then unbuttoned 2 buttons on his shirt. He opened it enough to show me a Kevlar vest beneath it.
"You see that? EMTs have to wear them around here because people shoot at us sometimes. Gangbangers, that kind of thing. We show up to try to save lives and people shoot at us."
"Must be tough," I said cautiously. He shook his head.
"I can handle it, but a lot of people don't.
And if it